This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations. Welcome, everybody. This is Chasing Encounters, episode 8. I'm happy to have Wales Wong today with me. She's a very interesting person, and I really admire the work that she does. Hello, Wales.
Hi, Issy. Thanks for having me on this podcast. It is definitely an honor. I have been secretly waiting for this invitation, so I'm very excited that I'm here today.
Awesome. So to start, we and our audience would like to know a little bit more about you, who you are, your family, community, what you've been up to lately, a little bit about you, your past, your present, future, etc.
So you said I had how much time for this?
Whatever time is necessary.
So in a nutshell, I'll go with like the usual introductions we have at the beginning of classes. I'm currently a PhD student at OISE in the Department of Curriculum Teaching and Learning in the Language and Literacies program. I did my master's there previously, and I came straight into this program, the PhD program that is, about almost 2 years now. And my research area of interest has been translanguaging and writing, and that's what my MA work was about, and I would like to continue doing that with my PhD work. Still kind of figuring things out, and you know, part of what I hope we can really kind of think about is just how storytelling is an important aspect of language learning, identity making, meaning making, like just so much of storytelling is a part of our everyday lives. That's in terms of my academic life. My personal life, I was born and raised in California. I like to talk about that a lot because people always ask me, why am I here with this weather? And I'm like, the people make this city so amazing to me. I cannot even express to you, like, that is the one thing that I always remember, the busyness of everything. It is truly a metropolis of, like, different things going on. You talk about diversity, it's here too. I know that there's always a very critical analysis of what multiculturalism actually means and what it can mean. But I think for what I've experienced living in California and then moving to Hong Kong when I was around 10, 11. I knew I was in grade 7 when I entered grade 7. And then coming to Toronto to do my undergrad, out of these three cities, I would say, and they are like in California, I lived in a small little city called Monterey Park, mainly Asian dominated, a lot of Chinese, a big Chinese community there. And then going to Hong Kong, again, a Chinese community, but mostly speaking Cantonese. And then here, also a large Chinese community, but you have all these enclaves of different communities situated based on their ethnicity, their culture, and or their languages. And there's a string that I feel that kind of connects all of these places together, but they are just so different when I think about the kind of interactions I had with people. And mind you, it's also the age differences too, right? So as an adult, I'm very happy here. Yeah.
Nice. I'm glad to hear many things that I didn't know before, but I'm so glad to know that you live in California for a while, then move to
Hong Kong, right? Yep.
So do you speak Cantonese at all?
Yes, I do speak Cantonese. Mandarin, nope, I don't. I was learning it in class, and it's one of those ironic things, is like the one thing I do study about, you know, understanding languages and how people use language in writing and in speaking. It also happens to be one of the biggest challenges in my life is learning a language. And the reason why I know Cantonese is because I grew up with it. You know, like when people ask me what's my first language, I'll usually say English. But if you ask me what was the first word I spoke, was it Cantonese or English? I don't know. My parents don't know. But it was pretty much at the same time that I was learning both languages. My experiences there kind of, I think, I think I'm a little bit spoiled in that respect, that I know Cantonese because it was a given. It was in my life every day because I spoke Cantonese with my parents. So I'm really glad that I don't have to learn it in a traditional class setting, because I do know that it's difficult to learn. You have to memorize characters and the tones. There's like 8 to 9 tones in Cantonese, whereas in Mandarin there's 4 tones, and even with that it's still it's difficult to learn when your writing systems are quite different. So that's my personal experience from it. So I really always in awe of other people that know multiple languages, different writing systems and such.
Nice. So can you tell us a little bit of when you use Cantonese, when you use Mandarin, and what, and when do you use English, or you sort of use them all together at some point? How does that work for you?
Sure. So Mandarin I don't use at all. I do try to communicate with others if there's, like if I'm traveling or if I see somebody that needs help and they happen to, because I think it's also something of like a physical appearance that people see me and they know that I'm Chinese. They do actually make the automatic assumption that I speak Mandarin, and I'm speaking of other Chinese people in the community that speak Mandarin. So I have to say, you know, in English I don't know, or I have to say in Cantonese, omzido. So they do. So sometimes by saying that, if they know I know Cantonese, they might actually know Cantonese and we can converse in that way. It's all dependent on where in China they came from, or if they had also did a transition period in Hong Kong before coming to North America. So that's one thing. And then the other part to it, when I use Cantonese, is mainly with my parents. And when I visit Hong Kong, I find my Cantonese comes back to me so quickly. But when my parents don't visit me in Toronto, I'm constantly just using English now. And I don't have a lot of other people that I can use Cantonese with. Then I find like I struggle with words when they come to visit. And the first month is me just kind of like doing these like pauses and like these ums and like just trying to describe to them what I want to get across in Cantonese, because their English is limited compared to mine, but they lived in America for like as long as I did, for 10 years. But they don't practice English a lot in their everyday conversation. So in terms of, you know, translanguaging, if we were to talk about that, I do that the most with my parents. I do that quite a bit with my friends. I have a lot of friends that came from Hong Kong too. Some that I knew from high school even, and some that I've recently known. And it's interesting to see when you think about the percentages of our conversation, if it's in Cantonese or in English, sometimes really is dependent on whether I've known them in Hong Kong in that context, or how long they've lived in Hong Kong. If they've lived in Hong Kong for a while, obviously the bulk of our conversation will be in Cantonese. I say obviously because it could be a matter of language proficiency for both of us. It could be a matter of just the content of our conversations could be very much about things that we understand in the culture, whether it's living in Toronto or living in Hong Kong. So yeah, that's where my translanguaging practices appear in my daily life.
Before, because I want to talk about translanguaging in a second, but before that, while you were speaking, it made me think of feelings and emotions when it comes to language, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder how you feel more. You feel more Chinese, you feel more Canadian, you feel more American. Where is this feeling or emotions? How do you feel more?
When it comes to speaking the languages or just in general?
In general, in general.
That is such a tricky question, you know? Like, it depends on the day. It depends what's happening that day. And sometimes it just kind of feels like I'm an imposter too, depending on who I'm with and what I'm talking about. You know, when I go down to the States to claim that I'm American, I feel like it's just an identifier rather than an actual identity, like a label rather than an identity, because I haven't lived in the States for so long, but yet, you know, my citizenship, my passport, everything about that says that I'm American. Then I'm in Canada, and then I want to say I'm Canadian, but literally just got my citizenship a couple of years ago, so then it's also one of those things where you think about what what labeling does, like how much it includes and excludes you from certain things. So then I say if I'm Chinese, that's also kind of weird because as people can, like, you know, if you had to look at me physically, be able to tell that I am Chinese. But if I'm in Hong Kong, like, I'm not going to say that. I don't need to say that. It's clear that because most of the population people are Chinese, right? Yeah, it's sure. It's there. So when it comes to languages, I think one of the things that I thought has been interesting is people can't tell what my accent is. And that's one of those things where I really never thought too much about. If you were to hear me speak in Chinese, then there would be some of, like, my friends would say, like, oh, yeah, you sound very juxing, which means that you sound very, like, westernized. It's a bit of a slang. I don't want to say that's derogatory. It's not. But it's a bit of a slang to say that. And I'm okay with it because I recognize that. But I do understand that for me to hear myself, I can't hear an accent when I'm speaking Cantonese. It's hard for me to differentiate that. And in English, it's hard for me to differentiate a Canadian and an American accent. I can't. And America's really quite it's diverse too in, if you want to talk about American accents, you know, being from the South or the West or East and so on, there's a number of different accents that you're going to hear there too. And I know with some of the work that's being done in this building at OISE, you know, when it comes to accent and a critical approach to it, and also the, you know, unfortunately, the racist undertones that come with talking about accents, I don't know. I hesitate to even comment on whether I have an accent or not. But that's kind of where I'm coming from.
I'm, as Wales is talking, I'm typing here some notes because everything is so interesting and I would like to ask many questions about many things, but I want to say two things in regards to labeling and based on your experience about your passport and traveling. Mm-hmm. It happened to me last year when I went to Europe and I was in Copenhagen and then hanging out with a few people, some people would ask, where are you from? And I said, Colombian. And then you notice the type of conversations they engage with you when you say Colombian, sort of hesitant, etc., right? But then in other spaces at the same time, I said, I am Canadian. And then all of a sudden, they look at me as if I could not be Canadian. I was like, how come you're Canadian? I don't understand. You don't look Canadian. So this idea of labeling is interesting. Sure enough, after that day, I started saying Canadian to everybody. Mm-hmm. And just to make them feel a little bit better of what it means to be Canadian. And also because to show this idea that Canadianese or being Canadian is not this white, tall, green-eyed dude, mm-hmm. but it can be this little guy who walks around, you know, and it doesn't look like at all Canadian. So in a sense, I was challenging these people's and mindsets of labeling people because of the way they look. Same thing like the accents as well. I remember sitting at a table and I was listening to a few people talking, like one person was American, the other one Canadian, and I could tell right away that person must be from Canada. I swear to God, both of them are speaking in English, but I swear to God, one of them, this person is from Canada. After a while, I jump into the conversation. I say, are you from Canada? He said, yeah, how do you know? We'll say, oh, I'm from Canada too. I'm from Toronto. Oh, really? Me too. I'm from blah, blah. And we started a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was amazed of myself how I could, and I was able to identify, you know, mm-hmm. the American accent and mm-hmm. the Canadian accent. But anyways, this podcast is not about me necessarily, but we have Wales today, and she's an expert in many topics. And today I want to ask you about the idea of translanguaging. What do you understand? In general terms, I don't asking you for anything specific or theoretical or academic necessarily, but in your work, what do you understand by translanguaging?
Well, my feeling is translanguaging is about a person's capacity to use their full language repertoire. And that, like, languages can mean a lot of things for different people. But I think in the instances of writing, the different writing systems that they know, in the instance of speaking, the different languages that they know. But this can also encompass body language. You know, like I had an interesting discussion with somebody last week in Atlanta, and he was from New Zealand, and he was just talking about just like the different languages, and that body language is one of the things too for him that he utilizes, right, and that he understands as a part of his occupation. That's not my background, though. My background is in more of like writing and speaking. So again, going back to that, using your full language repertoire and being able to communicate with other people, and using, I think, the more could be a little bit more dated, I guess, at this point, but still, like code switching, just being able to use different languages within a conversation, within a sentence, and there's a lot of strategic thinking that comes along with it to understand that when you compare different languages, syntax, grammar, vocabulary, and all that is quite different in some instances, so that when a person has the ability to be able to use two or more languages in one conversation, it's their brain, it's constantly thinking, it's like, you know, how am I going to use this in English when it's a part of speech as a noun? Does that quote unquote translate the same way when I'm speaking in Cantonese? Is this a noun? And I think that really fascinates me a lot, and that fascinated me a lot, and that's why I got into this program, doing the things that I am doing now. So yeah, that's what I would say about translanguaging.
No, that's nice. I just, like, whenever you're explaining this idea of translanguaging, it always made me think about the incident that happened recently about, I forgot who, but it's this white person or white baby being praised because she was already learning a second language at an early age, when the reality is our communities out there, racialized communities, have been learning languages and mixing languages and translanguaging for a long time, and yet they don't get the attention that this baby had in the media. So just a point to say that there are things happening out there in our societies where our marginalized communities have been translanguaging for so long, and then we need to start valuing those experiences in their communities. So my next question is related to writing, and I know you've been working a little bit on how translanguaging maps out on the writing of peoples out there, students and so on and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the work I've been doing has been with adult language learners, English language learners, and the school that I've been with is a continuing ed program. So a lot of these students, a lot of these adults are coming from, they're new arrivals, they could be newcomers, they're coming from other countries, and in search of work. You know, a lot of it is really about them coming and looking for work, and they may have graduated, they may from their home country with like a degree in certain fields, but coming here, they can't get a job because it's not recognized. So they go into the continuing education program, which provides high school credits for them to be able to get a high school degree. So as you can see, there's a lot of emotional and I would think psychological stress and pressure for them, because you're coming to a different country, trying to adjust, building a home for your family, and learning things that really you thought that you already knew, but then, you know, the school system, government says that, no, you're not ready, and you have to go back to school for it. So writing, communication, I should say, in general, is a very big aspect in this program. So I've taught in the ESL program, so English as a second language, with these students, and it's just fascinating the wide variety of backgrounds, places, occupations, and the futures that they see for themselves. It's heartbreaking sometimes because they have to go to school and work, and it's quite difficult when they have a family, have to take care of kids. And it's also, while we're in the class, it's fantastic to be able to hear those stories of how they came to Canada, why they're here. And I thought about it lately, in terms of just trying to figure out where my research wants to go, that storytelling, regardless of what language or languages that you know, is such an important aspect of how we make meaning in our life and how we see our life and which direction we want it to go in. And then if we think about that, our languages can also dictate that too, because the languages that we choose to say or speak of in regarding, like, you know, describing our everyday life can really have a big effect on how we perform in our lives too. There's a lot of psychological aspects of that too, which I can't speak to, but I always thought about how, like, when people think, you know, you think positively, then you'll have a good day. And I think about the languages that we speak too. It's like the cultural upbringing that we have that comes with it. If I had a very positive experience living in Hong Kong, and I think about all those experiences and I use Cantonese, is that going to change, and is that going to help me see my experiences now living in Canada in a different way, and vice versa? So that's kind of where the starting point of my conversation would begin when it comes to the research that I'm doing.
So you hope to do your research related to storytelling and sort of like the immigrants and where they're, what they're bringing with them, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So I know you have a little bit of experience on listening to these people's stories. I wonder what are the themes of those stories that you have heard so far? What is salient? What do you notice? What is noticeable out there that you have heard so far?
So anecdotally, just from my teaching experiences, students will always talk about what they did in their home country, or maybe there's an upcoming holiday or event that's related to it. So they like to talk to me about, you know, what are the practices, what are the traditions that we do when those things happen. Speaking to the master's research that I did 2 years ago, with three of my participants, I had asked them to produce a short story with the option to code switch. I did encourage them to code switch. That was a part of the study. And I'd said, you can write it as fiction or non-fictional, it doesn't matter to me. And in all three instances, one of the patterns I did notice was that whether it's fiction or non-fictional, there were always indications of references to their culture. So of course it would make sense, because if I'm gonna use Chinese in my writing, there would be something there that's going to relate to it. Like for one of the students, she talked about the Mid-Autumn Festival. It was an explanation of what she would do during the Mid-Autumn Festival. Another student talked about her aspirations now that she's living in Canada and her work ethics, and compared how the lifestyle of working here in Canada is quite different to what she was doing when she was living in China. So those two students wrote basically like a biography of their life, a short biography, a brief biography, like a life story. And then the third student, they were only asked to write about 3 to 5 pages. The third student wrote like over 20 some pages. It was a fantastic read. And she wrote a fictional story called The Blue Flamingo. And the more we delve deeper into it, it really was a story that represented, that main character represented her, how she stood out and she was different from everybody, and how she tried to fit in and all those challenges that came with fitting in. And even certain names in that story itself were references to people that, to celebrities. Well, in one instance, to a celebrity that I also know of who comes from China. So it's, you know, people write about what they know, you know, and languages are so much a part of our experiences that I think about how storytelling, if we were to encourage and support our students in using any of the languages they know, how much more they can bring to the class and they can bring to their writing, and how much more comfortable they would be in being able to break down these things because it's things that they know. When you tell somebody to write in a language that they're just learning about things that they know, it's always a struggle to get ideas onto the paper because they're trying to perfect the language before they're trying to actually communicate what is experienced.
You know, this is so interesting because as you're speaking, made me think when I am teaching or when I'm in different workshops teaching about intercultural competence, cultural awareness, all of those are some things that I think stories are very important, especially for immigrants, you know, to give them the space and the platform to tell their story. I think that's very, very important. But another question that I have even for myself, but I want you to hear your comments on this question, is how important is for us to be open about our own stories in front of our of the students, right? Like, I am very open. I talk to my students all the time and I tell them my background, where I'm coming from. The very first day of class or the very first day when I approach them on a workshop, etc. But how important is to you to open yourself about telling your own story to your students?
Well, that's the first thing I do with my classes. Right off the bat, I tell them where I'm from, like why I'm here, why I want to be here. It's a way of connecting. And that's the other part of storytelling. You know, we connect to people. I think that in everyday conversation, one of the things that I've noticed in the past couple of years and what I really value so much out of my friendships is when we come together, we are collaboratively storytelling together. You know, our conversation is a story in itself. And we collaborate. We make meaning from each other's words. Nobody's there to record it, but I have a memory of that, and that becomes another story that I can put into my treasure chest, right? So when I come to class as a teacher, I want these students to know I'm there to connect because I want to, because I want to know that they know that, you know, I'm there for them. And I can't be there for them if I'm holding on or hiding parts of my identity from them. I can't be there just as a teacher. I'm there as a human. I'm there as with a lot of these experiences too. I think about, it's very interesting that recently in a class that we talked about the positionality of a researcher, a teacher, and a therapist, you know, those three to compare. And those experiences, and I think about my personal experiences and understanding those three positions and those roles. And when you think about the person that's a therapist in the professional manner, they can't share that much with you. If anything, they're not supposed to share that much with you. And you're there telling them everything about yourself, you know, in hopes of really healing. And it's a very difficult relationship to have because it's one directional. You know, you're sitting there, you're being vulnerable, you're sharing all that information. And then I think about as a researcher and as a teacher, we often are placed in that situation too. As a researcher, you can't share too much about yourself. It really does depend on the kind of research you're doing. But in general, I would say that you can't share too much because you know, you don't want to have any biases against you. And you also have to be very clear about what your position is as like an insider and outsider with the students too. And that I know that there are more changes that are happening in the field when it comes to that. But as a teacher, then you're also told when you're teaching secondary students or elementary students that you can't reveal that much about yourself because there's a professional aspect to that too. You know, how much of my relationships outside of school can I tell my students so that they understand when they're having a bad day? It's like, yeah, I totally get it. That's happened to me and my parents too. And you know, you have to think about it yourself, right? You have to gauge yourself, and that's one of those professional skills that you learn over time. But it's very different from having friends and having those conversations where you can openly talk about so many things and allow for them to know more about your identity. So, you know, I go back to the beginning of what you had talked about with that question. I start off, I try to let them know as much as I can. They are adults, so I don't fear as much what my personal life could mean to them as much as I would for my younger population of students.
You know, Wales, I am so glad to hear what you just mentioned. And what I take from this little piece of conversation is the idea of connecting to people. We live in a world that, in my opinion, sometimes I feel that is disconnected in terms of humanity. And why not in our classes, in our day-to-day conversations, why not connecting ourselves to others and open ourselves and tell other people their stories, right? I think we should not keep this idea of being professional, quote-unquote, because I don't want to be out there mm-hmm. and show my emotional side to protect the professional aspect. So I do recommend folks out there to actually be open and be emotionally open whenever is possible, obviously. But in order to do that, so we can actually keep connecting with other people. So before wrapping up today, Wales, I would like to know, in this last section, is there anything that you want our audience to know about you, your work, your research, or anything related to anything that you want to tell us?
Ooh, this is a tricky part. There's so much, but I think, you know, like, go out and tell your stories. Go out and tell your stories in any and all of the languages that you know. There's always somebody that wants to hear it. And as you're telling your story, just being able to be reflective about what it is that you're choosing to tell people and what you're choosing not to tell people, I feel like that's already such a... it's a very therapeutic process too. And that in everyday conversation, you know, I hear it all the time from my students, like, I can't write a story. I don't even know like how to write a story. It's long, it's and yada yada. But we think about storytelling in such a traditional way that it has to be written in a certain format with a plot, the setting, like you have to have rising action, a climax, and then falling action, and then the ending. I'm so used to that plot diagram at this point. But, you know, that's a starting point. I get that. But storytelling does not have to follow a formula. That's not what storytelling about. Storytelling is about. Storytelling is about us, as Hesita said, connecting with people, being able to talk about experiences, whether they're fictional or not. But I always think that even in the most fictitious tales, there is so much truth to it. So I would leave you with that.
All right, Wales, I think this has been a fascinating story today, especially the idea of go out and tell your story. I think that's the message for today's podcast. Get up from that chair and tell somebody that story that you have never said. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Wow. I just feel like I want to do karaoke right now. This is like so awesome.
Do you do a lot of karaoke?
Well, I haven't for a while. I'm trying to like get people to go, but it's like the scheduling is difficult. But I practice on my own in the car.